Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, the wine for this episode is actually a leftover. There was a week that we were both quite under the weather and we're drinking tea. This is what we were going to drink, and I honestly don't remember what it was supposed to match.
Oh, nice, because it's got farm animals on it, and it's called Belle Fermée. It is. It's a product of France. And I must say, it's not very good.
No, I'm agreeing with you. We should probably not even name it. Just, you know, it's a terrible bottle of wine.
And I can't think of anything. It really doesn't match anything this week, does it? Can you make something up? Just sort of.
Well, you know, actually, here, it's taking us back, because we used to drink a lot of terrible wines, and we had been on a good streak lately. And speaking of going back to your roots, let's talk about Guy Ritchie. Is that stretch enough for you?
Whoa, that's almost as twisty as the plot of this film.
Back in 1998, a director out of Britain burst onto the art house scene and became a beloved auteur figurehead amongst a certain sect of cinephile. His name is Guy Ritchie, and everybody loved Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
A.K.A. Madonna's ex-husband.
Yeah, he's known for other things.
Yes, but that's how most people know the name.
He was so funny and witty and British slangy and gritty and out there, and anything could happen. And then he doubled it. He one-upped himself in 2000 with Snatch. People still quote this movie. I know I do, especially Brad Pitt's turn as a pikey. The ins and outs of everything that could and should and does happen in that film is still my favorite Guy Ritchie film. I loved that movie. And then he continued Revolver, Rock and Rolla, and then Hollywood said, we got it. You're the man. Come here. Take all of our Hollywood money and make Sherlock Holmes, and then make the sequel to Sherlock Holmes because it made $1 billion, and then remake The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Which I loved, by the way. That was the Armie Hammer one, wasn't it?
It was a wonderful film. And then remake Aladdin.
Mm-hmm.
And buried somewhere in the middle there, buried in between, now forgotten, Guy Ritchie pulled a Gigli. He pulled a Ben Affleck J-Lo with a film called Swept Away. Pop culture lit him up for directing his then-wife Madonna in what they said was one of the worst films ever made. I've never seen it.
I've never seen it.
Swept Away. He's back. Guy Ritchie is back. He says, I'm going back to my roots, my comedy, my grit, my Britain, my slang, my crazy over-the-top screenplay, and we are the better for it. I'm so happy he has come home. This screenplay, this ensemble, the whack-a-mole story, which is quite hard to latch onto at times, is everything I wanted it to be. Hannah, I had such a good time watching The Gentleman.
You did, and it's a Guy Ritchie movie, and it is a guy movie, and so the guys certainly seem to love this movie more than any of the women around me did. Not to say that women didn't enjoy the film, I just think that the guys definitely were watching it on a slightly different plane than others. Maybe my biggest sort of the worst rub with this is that they keep using the C word, the four-letter C word for female anatomy.
A lot.
And it was just, all it was for me was this constant reminder that this film was obviously written by a guy. But
Brits use that far more than we do.
Sure, but hell, you're on American soil with this movie right now, and so the women are going to cringe when it's used as frequently as it is. But this is a very stylish crime caper. It's a smart film. It's witty. You talk about sort of the comeback of Guy Ritchie returning to his roots. I kind of thought, you know, it's a little bit Matthew McConaughey sort of redeems himself a little bit from some duds in the recent year or two, and he's very good in this film. It is heavy on the testosterone. It's got all these guys. It's Matthew McConaughey, Charlie Hunnam. I mean, and women are going to appreciate these guy actors too. Henry Golding, who most people really just got introduced to in Crazy Rich Asians. You know, here he was this model and TV personality who has really proven himself to be a decent actor. And you can just see him getting better with each role that he's in. And Colin Farrell's in this in a very fun role. But to me, the best actor in this, and sort of talk about playing against type, it's Hugh Grant. And I love Hugh Grant in this film.
Just recently, Hugh Grant was in Paddington 2, and I saw a one-liner review that says, Hugh Grant is so versatile, he has gone from Paddington 2 to using the C word 200 times.
Yes, and he is. He's so versatile. And this just shows how versatile he really is. And when you talk about this being a very stylish film, I mean, right down to the suits, or, you know, the wardrobe for the men is such a big part of it. And there is one female. So sort of the estrogen in this film is provided really by Michelle Dockery from Downton Abbey. And she's in some very lethal looking Christian Louboutin stilettos at the beginning, and I was sure she was gonna like kill somebody with her shoes.
Michelle Dockery plays Lady Mary in Downton Abbey, and she is anti-Downton here. In fact, the language she uses would also murder,
yes,
the Downton Abbey cast. And I thought she was one of the, she has very limited screen time as Matthew McConaughey's wife, but apparently she's also the power behind the scenes, and I just loved watching her. She has such firm screen presence for me in this film. Ritchie could have chosen to tell a standard crime caper from beginning to end linear story, but he did not. He uses a gimmick, a narrative device, and it's Hugh Grant doing it. Hugh Grant is a private eye, and he shows up at Ray's house, Charlie Hunnam's house, and he says, I'm going to tell you a story. Play a game with me. And he tells it in screenplay format. You know, he says, the protagonist. And he talks about edits and cuts and cinema lingo. And so he says something, and then for the next 10 minutes, we flash back to what happened. What happened? What was McConaughey doing here? What was Hunnam doing here? What was Colin Farrell doing here? Then we come back to Hugh Grant. All right, here's where we are. Now here's where we're going. And they really do play games. They do voiceover games. It works for me. I can recognize this might not work for everyone. Mm-hmm. People might think it's cute or unnecessary. I thought it was creative and original and fun. I actually, about two-thirds of the way through the movie, I was sitting there and I popped out of it for a second in my head, and I just thought, I'm having fun right now. I'm enjoying myself.
I could tell. It's so rare for to see you enjoying yourself in the middle of a film like that. But I do think it was a tad self-indulgent. I think, you know, it sort of is, you know, it's patting himself on the back a lot in terms of Guy Ritchie. Not there's a, you catch a poster in there for The Man from U.N.C.L.E.,
which Hugh Grant was in.
And there's a lot of connections throughout this film to, you know, Guy Ritchie having worked with some of these folks before. But I just personally, I thought that some of that was self-indulgent, and the cinephiles, you know, it's definitely catering to Guy Ritchie's fan base. And so while I did not enjoy it as much as you did, I still could appreciate that it was this interesting balance of sophisticated and campy.
There's a Tarantino flavor going on in here. And like every Tarantino film, it's not everyone's cup of tea.
No, but fortunately for those, you know, like the Tarantino violence can really turn people off. The violence in this is not very prolonged. Like there's blood spatter and there's cringeworthy moments.
You know, a lot of it's unnecessary. Yeah. And talk about a gimmick. They'll do something, like McConaughey will do something really violent, and then Hugh Grant's narrator voice will come on, but we both know he's not like that, and that didn't happen. So yeah. It's actually, he only filmed it just to actually give us some violence that doesn't actually fit the film.
Yeah, and I mean, it's still very much, you know, like this crime, drama, action, comedy combo, And you know, Matthew McConaughey's character is this expat American who's running this marijuana business in Empire, really, in London. And it's about him wanting to sell the business and go off into the sunset with his wife. And of course, you know, that can never really happen when you're a drug kingpin. You can't just sort of quietly walk away. And so really, that's the premise. That's where Hugh Grant is playing this sort of PI who knows where all the bodies are buried, so to speak. And so he's trying to, you know, kind of blackmail everybody and sell out with his information to the highest bidder. So there's a lot of, you know, double just sort of backstabbing going on, and you never quite know whether what you're seeing is the reality or whether it's, you know, going to take some other turn. So it's interesting. It's entertaining. You're right. It's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but absolutely, certainly for the folks that are Guy Ritchie fans, this is going to be one of your favorites of him.
Did you pick up on the theme of the generational divide? So McConaughey, Hunnam, they're Gen X. They're a little tired. They're not slow yet, but they're tired, and they have a wider vision than they used to. And Henry Golding and the toddlers, the boys who train for Colin Farrell, coach, they're millennials. The toddlers raid one of McConaughey's marijuana farms. And what's the first thing they do? They post it online. They edit it, and they post it, and they brag about it, and they boast about it. And you know, and their generation is, why commit crime if you're not going to tell everybody you committed the crime? In fact, here's a video of me committing the crime. And the Gen Xers are looking at them, not necessarily with distaste, but which is just, I don't understand you people kind of looks. And there's, I think that was a heavy theme throughout the film.
That's part of it, you know, that the times are changing. And, you know, when you've got somebody who's trying to sort of move on from the business, you've got these, you know, up and comers competing for territory. And so the Henry Golden character, he was sort of like, I think they refer to him as kind of like a Chinese James Bond kind of look. And so, yeah, he's got an interesting kind of character going. And I did love Hunnam's consigliere role. It was actually very good. It was well played.
He plays the straight man, because Hugh Grant is out there. Colin Farrell is peculiar at the best.
Yeah, quirky.
Hunnam's Ray is, he's the straight man. Yeah. He's the reactor.
Right. And so I love the dynamic between Hunnam and Grant in this film. So it's, you know, you gave it 3.5 stars, which for you, I mean, I was like, oh my goodness, you really like this film.
for a January film.
And
as well.
So for a January film, absolutely, it's a decent pick.
All right. You saw the next film we're going to talk about, The Last Full Measure, and it's about a man that people in my community know very well. It's a very, very famous name. And who are we going to talk about?
This is one you absolutely should have seen over me in order to get your perspective. But it is about a U.S. Air Force pararescue jumper, or PJ, William Pitzenberger. Pitzenberger?
Pitzenberger.
Pitzenberger. And this is a guy who really gave his life to save others in a very bloody battle during the Vietnam War in 1966. And he was really deemed deserving of a Congressional Medal of Honor. But for some reason, he did not get that medal. Instead, he got the highest medal awarded by the Air Force. But for the next 30 some odd years, people were sort of lobbying for his case to really get reexamined. And so this film is really about that combination of the Pentagon bureaucracy going on and a way to flash back and tell the story of this real-life American hero. So it's a very – I looked it up. It's doing okay. It's actually got a fresh tomato on Rotten Tomatoes. But I think it really falls flat. And I think the problem is that it's a hard movie to criticize – because it means well. And, you know, whenever you have one of these films inspired by actual events, and it's got some heavy hitters. You've got Christopher Plummer, William Hurt, Ed Harris, Samuel L. Jackson, Diane Ladd, the late Peter Fonda in his final role, all giving these very eloquent, although a little over-the-top soliloquies throughout really talking about war experiences and why Pitzenbarger deserved the Medal of Honor. And then you have Sebastian Stan, who most people would actually recognize as Bucky Barnes in the Marvel Universe. He's playing a not real guy. His character is a composite character who is this career Pentagon staffer who's tasked with investigating the very long dormant Medal of Honor request. And he thinks that he's just going to end up kind of brushing it all under the rug again and moving on to another job. But in talking to Pitzenbarger's family and in his war buddies, then this guy sort of takes on the mantle of this fight. And I, you know, it's just a really tough film to kind of recommend because it felt more like a tribute film that should have been shown on Memorial Day weekend or Veterans Day. And the fact that it takes a true story and has a lot of fictionalization going on around it is always a bit of a problem for me. And when your sort of lead character is one of these composite characters that you cannot go and look at and say, yes, this really happened. This guy, this Pentagon staffer, you know, uncovered a conspiracy and finally got this airman the medal that he so long deserved and his parents were able to accept on his behalf. It's that tough road of Hollywood where you're mixing reality and fiction, and that doesn't always sit well with me. It's very much one of those labor of love movies. It's a passion project that a lot of people obviously probably did it for scale. And it is definitely, there's a reason that it's really a small indie film that is not getting all that much attention.
I can feel how a true story, but a manipulated true story that is made for feelings instead of true impact might come off as platitudes and stale and maybe feel like a Hallmark Channel production at times. I'm very familiar with that kind of genre. It's a shame. I'm not saying it's a shame. I haven't seen it, so I'm not saying it's a shame that they did this to Pitzenbarger's story, but just know that within the United States Air Force, he still has a very famous name. There's an annual award that they give to the most courageous and the most brave airmen throughout the year. He's still taught in Air Force schools. His story is not lost. It's just now going to reach somewhat of a more limited audience. But I do understand the genre you're talking about, that it's just so saccharine.
It felt like a very high-profile, A-list-filled home TV movie of the week. Mm-hmm. And it's really meant to... It's meant to be inspiring and to it does not get very political. You know, it kind of shies away from that. It's really meant to just underscore the sacrifice of the of veterans and their families and his story. He is definitely, he was one of very few airmen to actually get the Congressional Medal of Honor. And so you learn a little bit about that. But yeah, it was just a little heavy-handed in its approach. I thought the script was just a little bit over the top, and I just think it might be one of those ones where the truth was good enough that some of the dramatization and fictionalization of characters and events was not necessarily necessary.
All right. Well, even though it feels like we've been in it for about 4 months now, we're still in awards season. The Golden Globes are over. The Critics' Choice Awards are over. The Oscars nominations are out, but they haven't happened yet. And always in that time frame, we run into the Screen Actors Guild Awards. Now, Hollywood is made up of guilds. The Directors Guild votes for the DGA, the Producers Guild, the Writers Guild. But this is the Screen Actors Guild, and they are by far, quantity-wise, the largest guild. There are more actors than anybody else. And I'm not saying it always happens, but it's a harbinger. The SAG Awards are very strong, not always, but a very strong predictor of who will win come Oscar night. Now look at these four main, two supporting, two main actors from SAG Award winners who I would be shocked if they didn't stand up on Oscar night. Starting with the supporting, Laura Dern and Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Do you honestly not expect to see them stand up on Oscar night?
No, absolutely. Actually, those four you're talking about were sort of shoo-ins. Joaquin Phoenix for Best Actor.
And Phoenix and Zellweger.
Renee Zellweger for Best Actress. Yeah, those have been sort of the repeats throughout. And obviously, going into the Oscars now are really heavily favored.
But there are exceptions to the rule. Adrian Brody. It happens, which is why it's so special when something like that does. But 99% Oscar pool, those are your four. It's just going to happen. Grin and bear it. There was one big surprise of the night. They do not have a Best Picture category at SAG Awards. It's called Best Ensemble, since you're honoring an entire cast. There was a sort of favorite going in. Now, 1917, which is a leading contender for Best Picture, not even nominated because it's not an acting film. Therefore, people thought, all right, here's your time, Quentin Tarantino. Once upon a time in Hollywood, get ready to go up on stage. There was a whiff of maybe also Rance, maybe Irishman, maybe Jojo Rabbit, but get ready, Hollywood. And boom! Huge knockoff surprise. Open the envelope. Best Ensemble. Parasite.
Where none of the award winners could speak English. I mean, it was really a shock for a group of actors from a foreign film to win this top SAG award. But what I found most interesting about that choice, though, is here you have what is supposed to be best performance by a cast in a motion picture, and yet not a single one of those cast members was nominated for an acting award in the individual categories.
Because, it's very hard for, I think, American actors to judge foreign performances.
But at the same time, they're saying this is what we consider to be the best performance by a group of actors in a film, and yet none of them were nominated individually. And I just thought that, to me, that's sort of like the Greta Gerwig snub with the Oscars, where you go, okay, six other nominations for Little Women, but Greta Gerwig doesn't get a Best Director nod for putting it all together. So that, to me, was just the biggest surprise, is that, you don't have any individual nominations for the Parasite folks, and yet they win for Best Ensemble.
What this does is it drives a stake into the heart of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's chances of winning Best Picture. It's now a two-horse race between 1917 and Parasite. Though it's 51-49, 50-50 odds, one of those will now win Best Picture.
I'm still amazed at how many people think Parasite is a horror movie that has something to do with, like, an organism gone awry. And so I'm getting a lot of questions about what is this Parasite and why do I keep hearing it, and is it really that good? And it's one that is gaining in notoriety, and certainly the SAG Award helps put it further on the map for American audiences. So I'll be interested to see what kind of impact that has. I just remember crossing my fingers that Roma would not win Best Picture, even though it was nominated for both Best Picture and in the Best Foreign Picture category. And it's the same situation with Parasite, where, I don't know, I'm perfectly fine with it getting the Best Foreign Film Award at the Oscars, but I don't see it. To me, it's not the best picture, but it's a good picture, but it's not the best picture.
Now, well, we'll see, but I would be very surprised. And Parasite didn't even make my top 10, but I really like the film, and I would be so happy to see it win Best Picture.
It would certainly be a shocker, just because people would just sort of look at their ballots and be like, oh gosh, I had no idea what that film even was.
Now, even though The Gentleman feels like the biggest film of the week, and it's going to make more money than the other release, we did not see the biggest release, which is on more screens than The Gentleman, and it's called The Turning. it feels like one of those January horror pictures. It's actually based on Henry James's story, The Turn of the Screw. Father hires a governess because he's now inherited his nephew and niece, who are now orphans, played by Finn Wolfhard and Brooklyn Prince. So two kid actors we know well.
Well, and I mean, it opened cold, which never bodes all that well.
That's a horror sign.
Yes, when it's a sign that just goes, you know, horror movies do well enough without having to have critics weigh in on them because it's not for you. It's for the horror fans out there. And so they just kind of figure it's going to do well enough, do better to not have the press previews. Although you did catch up on one that was considered pretty rotten last week that I didn't hate as much as many of the critics did. But what did your 7-year-old think about Doolittle?
So 7-year-olds like everything. They don't care what they see. They like going to the movies and they like seeing things on big screens. So I asked him at the end, hey, he's never really rated anything and he loves everything. Hey, I had 4 stars. What'd you think of Doolittle? I don't know, Dad. I think I'd give it a 2. He didn't like it either.
And that really surprised me because I thought for sure, you know, the kids around me when I saw it seemed to really enjoy it. But I don't know, maybe you're rubbing off on him and he's going to be like a little grumpy critic.
No, he's still enamored by cinema and he really does like everything, even the true trash. But Doolittle was awesome. Very just strange and off-putting film. Downey's performance especially turned me off. He was not facilitating Doolittle.
I was much kinder and gentler when it came to reviewing and rating that film. I didn't hate it.
Did you see that the Washington Post gave it 0 stars?
I think that was harsh. I think a lot of critics were like way overly harsh. And, you know, yeah, it's not going to be a classic. It's going to fade away and it's going to be, $100 million bust. But I suspect, you know, in the streaming market and when it's available for rental, I think more kids are going to still watch it and appreciate it for the talking animals.
Well, you caught up on one. It's dual nominated. It's a very rare category, too, but both for Best International Film, Foreign Film, and Best Documentary. You finally caught up with Honeyland. I saw it about 6 weeks ago, way in early December. And I loved Honeyland. Tell me you loved Honeyland as much as I did.
I'm sure I did not love it as much as you did. It's a slow burn observational documentary. And you told me that while, you know, I wouldn't hate it, that I probably wouldn't love it. And that's true. Again, I am so angry that Apollo 11 did not make the best documentary.
Honeyland did not steal its spot. It was always going to get nominated.
But I don't feel when I watch something like Honeyland versus something like Apollo 11, there's just not even a comparison.
You're right. Honeyland is better.
No, I don't think so.
No joke.
And
it's better.
So I just don't agree. And so it's, it's just one of these kind of sad films about the last beekeeper, wild beekeeper in Macedonia.
Well, this lady we're watching in North Macedonia, who's on the wrong side of, well, for that land, 16, but she's 40 something, I think. And she lives like we used to live in antiquity.
Yeah.
No phone, no electricity, nothing. And her bed is like a slab of concrete.
And her mom is bedridden and living on another slab of concrete.
But she is at one with nature. She talks to these bees, and they provide her a lot of very good honey that she sells at market until this nomadic family trucks in their caravan next door with their pack of kids, and it becomes almost a dystopian nightmare.
Well, I don't know. It's like it was a double-edged sword for her because I think in some ways it really brought some life into her existence with the kids running around as wild as they were. But then they kind of steal her thunder, steal her business essentially out from under her. And that's when it becomes just really sad.
They do not respect
competition. They
nature.
They don't respect what she has, the way of beekeeping that she has so carefully preserved. She's in this village with no electricity, no running water. And so, you know, I was constantly just amazed at how this was being shot because I think it was shot over the course of several years. And so to take hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of footage and create like this 90-minute or so documentary, it is very impressive because you are just slowly watching things unfold and watching her go about her business with the bees. And and taking care of her mother. And it gets very sad and melancholy. But I felt I was relieved. I did look up a little bit later that proceeds from this documentary actually allowed her to move into a new home closer to relatives. And wouldn't you know it, those neighbors had yet another kid. I think that made like 8 kids.
I believe everything about it.
Yeah, but so it's a good documentary, but it is another one of those films that is not going to be everyone's cup of tea. And it is very sort of slow to unfold, and you are just kind of observing. You're just a bee on the wall.
I would love to see Guy Ritchie's Honeyland.
Oh my goodness, it would be the soundtrack would have been phenomenal.
I want to hear all the bees say the C word.
Yes, oh my goodness. But again, I'm glad I saw it because it's another one that I needed to tick off the list before the Oscars, so that I can fairly evaluate where it stands in relation to some of the other films that are nominated.
I only have 2 left. I have 2 left. I have 1 foreign film and 1 like visual effects left.
Well, because you saw Edge of Democracy, which I still need to catch up on.
And when you do, we'll probably tell everybody what happens next week about Edge of Democracy.
We're on the edge of our seats.
Quick recap. The Gentlemen is the best film of the week.
I can't argue with that. It's a Guy Ritchie guy movie, but it's still, for everyone, probably the best film choice of the week.
And there is girl power in it.
She holds nonsense. Michelle Dockery holds her own with the guys.
The last full measure.
I would just sort of save it for Veterans Day or Memorial Day viewing, or hope that maybe it gets put onto TV that way. But it means well, but it falls flat.
I do not believe we have any more televised award shows until the Oscars. Therefore, on Sunday, we allow you have our permission to go watch the Grammy Awards.
That's right. Well, because maybe some of the songs that make the cut for Best Original Song maybe will somehow miraculously make it into the Grammys. But I was very excited to see that all the original artists for the songs being nominated for Best Original Song at the Oscars will be performing them. So I'm looking forward to that.
And while it's a catch-up review, Honeyland absolutely is one of the top 5 documentaries of the year.
If you are into beekeeping, absolutely, I think you should see this one.
If you're into beekeeping, okay. Well, thank you very much for listening to this beekeeping episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.